Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a it sounds like I say this every day, and maybe I do, but we have a terrific group of individuals, just amazing people who are here with us to try to make sense of this world we live in and things that have happened over the last several hours. And we will get to them in just a moment. I am always humbled by the great minds that enter the studio each and every day, and so pleased to share them with you this morning. We welcome you to be a part of this. We certainly don't want to keep it all to ourselves. It's the giving season, after all. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org, and you can send us a note. Keep it short and to the point, and we'll get to as many as we possibly can in the time we have together. Let me introduce the group to you. Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner Ashley Dittus is with us. Good morning, Ashley. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm well. How are you?
I'm well. It's really nice to see you. Thank you so much for coming in. How are things in Ulster County this morning?
Things are great in Ulster County. I got to carpool this morning with my fellow panelist, which was very nice.
So fun.
we try to encourage that whenever possible, and it's nice when
saving the planet in the electric car that we drove here together, and you're welcome.
Yeah. Boy, you are public radio. the other occupant of that vehicle is Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead Anna Markowitz. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks to my fabulous carpool.
Excellent. Well, good. So I just imagine that you two have sort of warmed up, right?
We're ready.
You've already rehearsed.
Oh, yeah. We know everything that's happened in the last 24 hours, and we have digested.
You're ready to... Ashley, I'm going to say this. What do you think?
No. I wish that we were that on topic.
No, going to keep it fresh. I understand. Laurel Elder is with us, professor of political science at Hartwick College in Oneonta and co-director of the Institute of Public Service. Laurel, good morning. How are you?
I am doing well. It's such an honor to be here with you. And if I might, I just wanted to take a quick moment and add my voice to others over the past couple of weeks who have been acknowledging the recent passing of Professor Vera Icarius Kelly, who obviously was a frequent guest on this program. And I just wanted to say the very first time I was invited to be on the roundtable, I was thrilled. I also had no idea what I was doing. And sensing my need for help, your amazing producer, Sarah LaDuke, put me in touch with Vera, and she offered me advice, and I still carry it with me every time I'm on the show. She told me, I mean, it's simple but yet profound. She said, keep your comments focused and concise. Don't undercut your own expertise, which I thought was good advice, especially for women. And don't interrupt your fellow panelist. So anyway, she was on the panel with me that first time. As all your audience knows, she was so insightful, so smart, so interested, so kind. And really, I just wanted to say my heart goes out to all her students, her colleagues, her, you know, family and friends who are missing this light in their lives right now.
It's been a profound loss, and those are beautiful words. And I think, I've learned this over time, that our panelists tend to work together and help each other. And that's a lovely thing that comes out of this, and it certainly doesn't surprise me with Vera at all. I did mention last week, if anyone missed it, there is the obituary has been printed and is out online, and been printed in the TU and other places and on legacy.com, that if you go, it's a gorgeous obituary, and if you get to read it, also mentions that there will be a memorial service for her at Siena College in April. And we'll give you more information about that, but just to give you an idea of where they're headed. But if you want to read up more on her amazing life and what she accomplished in her very brief time on this planet, you can certainly look at it there. It's a beautiful tribute to a beautiful human being. Also, we welcome Associate Professor of Music at Vassar College, Justin Patch, is with us, who studies music in American politics, sound studies, East Asian art music, and music in the African diaspora. Good morning, Justin. It's always a thrill to have you here. Thank you.
Morning, Joe. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much. All right, let's get started on the stuff of the day. And there is, I guess there always is, but there's a lot of stuff. We'll begin with the, I don't know if you missed it, but if you didn't, or if you did, we're here to tell you about it. The president spoke to the nation last night at 9 o'clock. I don't know. He seemed to be in a hurry, but it was it was very quick. And I think they told him he was only going to get 15 minutes from the network, and he tried to make the most of that time. And so the address was to bring us, as advertised, it was to bring us up to speed on where things are going, the accomplishments over the last 11 months of the Trump administration. And also, it was said by Carolyn Leavitt that it would be a roadmap to the future of the next year as to what we would be seeing. I don't think none of us thought that yesterday, and I don't think any of us were really surprised that instead it turned out to be, I believe the first words were, "I inherited a mess." So the president gave this speech in repeated criticism of Democrats and his predecessor, Joe Biden, along with boasts about gains that many Americans have said they are not personally experiencing. The president has been on the defensive recently over the issue of affordability, which congressional Democrats hope to use to sweep back into power during the midterm elections, capitalizing on voters' concerns with the high cost of living in America, wielding charts and figures, most of them misleading. Mr. Trump tried to make the case that the economy is improving, or at least that the bad parts of it are not his fault. So, just the good parts, all him. Bad parts, not him. 11 months ago, I inherited a mess, and I'm fixing it, said Mr. Trump, who spoke loudly and at a very fast clip. This from the New York Times. The speech resembled comments Mr. Trump often makes while speaking to reporters in the Oval Office, full of self-praise of his administration, as well as certainly being very disparaging over his predecessor, President Joseph Biden. But he had a wider audience than usual, with networks interrupting their regularly scheduled programming to carry his remarks. If you were watching Survivor or The Floor on Fox, you had to wait a few minutes, and I hope you're happy. So with that delay, we did find out that we're the hottest country anywhere in the world, and that's said by every single leader that I've spoken to over the last 5 months, said the president. In a surprising moment, Mr. Trump announced what he called a warrior dividend, in which checks of $1,776, otherwise known as 1776, see what he did there, will be sent to some 1.4 million members of the military. The president said the money would come from tariffs that he has levied on goods imported into the country. The checks are already on the way. Mr. Trump promised the economy would improve in the next year and that his policies would cause prices on electricity and everything else to fall dramatically. He said mortgage payments will be coming down even further early in the new year, and he said he would announce some of the most aggressive housing reform plans in American history next year. Again, the latest attempt for the president to counter Democrats on the issue of affordability, which the president has time and again referred to as a fake narrative and a con job. All right. That is where we are. Who would like to start off?
Sure.
Anna?
Well, every time I hear Trump speak, I understand why sports fans yell at the screen. there were so many times that I was just like, that's not true. One of my favorite ones was healthcare. He's saying, oh, well, it's because of the Unaffordable Care Act that we're going to have such unreasonable health insurance costs moving forward. Has nothing to do, obviously, with the subsidies that all of the Republicans voted to have expire at the end of this year, which is really going to be the cost. So it's interesting to see how he's trying to spin things that he and his party have done to hurt affordability as somehow a Democrat's cause. So there was that. And the whole affordability thing that he has somehow brought down the cost of everything, even though inflation continues to be 3%, just the same as it was during Biden. And a lot of it is caused just by the tariffs that he unilaterally decided to impose. So, you know, I left being unimpressed, which is, I'm sure, shocking to everybody.
One thing Katie Rogers, who's a White House reporter for The New York Times, said they were live commenting on their site last night, said Trump relied on a lot of old strategies in his remarks. He blamed his predecessor. He promised more relief if people just keep waiting this time until next year to see the change in their paychecks. He floated a cash giveaway. The new thing here was his rushed and angry tone, which suggested the pressure he is under to provide the real economic relief he promised on the campaign trail, and Americans are signaling they aren't feeling it yet. Laurel.
Yeah, I was thinking about, I mean, is this a successful choice that he made to give this national address, primetime address? And I think in general, it's a good idea. Presidents don't actually have that much power given to them in the Constitution to affect economic policy and to bring down the costs of things. But yet Americans do expect that of them now. So they're under a lot of pressure and they don't have a lot of constitutional tools to actually do a lot about it. And a presidential historian, Richard Neustadt, said that the president's most powerful power is his power to persuade. So here he has an opportunity to talk to the American people and say, I feel your pain. Here's what we're doing about it. And, you know, really my question was it successful or not? And I think the way to judge that is obviously people who, you know, most Democrats who have not liked Trump and do not think he's doing a good job and haven't for the last decade, you know, to find out that they did not find his speech persuasive is not surprising. And then most Republicans have been with him the whole time and approve of him no matter what he's said, no matter what he's done. Approval from Republicans has been like 90%. But there are a growing number of Republicans who say they're not happy with the state of the economy. Maybe like 30% now say that they disapprove of Trump's performance on the economy. So my real question is, for those Republicans who are saying, yeah, I like Trump, but I'm not feeling great about the economy, did that speech win them back? Did that make them feel more comfortable and confident about the direction our nation is going in? And for the very small portion of Americans who are truly like not attached to either of the party, did they hear anything in that speech that made them feel more confident about the future?
It's interesting, too, because this was done a full month, basically, before the president will give the State of the Union address, where much of this would have been said and I'm sure will be repeated again. So this was like an extra opportunity, which some question as to whether that was a good strategy or not. Justin?
Yeah, I mean, I think my feeling is that this smells like desperation. I think Tom Nichols' comment last night on The Atlantic basically said the same thing. And there's no policy in there. I mean, you made a lot of promises. You're going to lower prices. You're going to do this, do that on day one. It doesn't
happen. You just
happen.
Wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, it's the wait and see thing. And increasingly, it seems like tariffs are paying for everything except for the tax cuts that they were supposed to pay for. And I think that this is going to become one of those things that people are going to start asking questions about, you know, your deficit hawks who said tariffs, tariffs, tariffs. And then suddenly, well, you're cutting a check for farmers who are hurt by tariffs. You're handing out checks to folks in the military. You're doing military operations in the Caribbean. Well, what about the tax cuts? Like, I thought tariffs were supposed to fill that hole, not pay for all of these other things. And this is going to be one of those policy issues. The other thing that we're looking at is that the job growth has been slow. Right. And so he keeps talking about wages and wages and this, that. And the other thing, if you don't have a job, that's irrelevant to you. And I think that's the other big piece of the economy that I didn't see addressed last night. And that is burning a hole in a lot of people who have to go home over break and deal with their constituents.
Again, Katie Rogers said that was an 18-minute speech that will keep fact checkers busy for many, many hours. Ashley.
Yeah, so after his speech was over, I turned to my husband, who also works in politics, and we both were just like, well, he didn't really say anything. I kind of thought we would get some announcement that your average American would get a refund. That's something he's been brandishing in some of these other speeches that he's made in Pennsylvania. Maybe we'll use the tariffs to give everybody a $2,000 check. That did not happen. It was an angry message, and not even his best angry message. So if he was off his game, I don't know what was going on with the microphone or if it was just him yelling, but it was not your usual Trump swagger that that his base loves. So even for the true MAGA loyalists, I didn't think that that was the chum that he was thinking it would be. AOC noted that tomorrow, on Friday, there will be a release of Epstein files. Mm. There's the Vanity Fair article that dropped this week. There was obviously another strike on a boat last night. All of these things that are going on, his approval ratings are the lowest that they've been all year. His strong disapproval ratings just are 52%, according to the Siena poll. He is going into, now Congress is not going to meet again until 2026. He's going into the holidays where people are feeling the burdens of the economy. And it's sort of interesting to me that Joe Biden had a similar issue with the economy, where the economy was doing better, inflation was going down, we did better than any other G7 country as far as coming out of the inflation from the pandemic. Trump is struggling with that same issue of being the president where the economy is starting to do better, but people aren't feeling it. And it's the feeling that average Americans have that is what is driving the politics behind it. So it's going to be an interesting 2026 with the midterms. Is he going to be the face of all of these congressional battleground districts, one of which is close to me with the Mike Lawler district? Is that who they want to be their messenger? They are running away from the healthcare issue. Tariffs are killing people. There's going to be even more coming in January with the cost of wood products, all your furniture that you put together on the weekend from Wayfair. That's going to be 50% higher. So that's what hurts average Americans. And I think that that's going to be a consistent problem while he is having Great Gatsby parties and building a ballroom. The mask is slipping and people are seeing it. And that's going to set themselves up for a blue wave, as it were, next year.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back and continue our conversation on this morning. We welcome you as well, right after BBC News. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Thursday, the 18th of December. It's 33 minutes past at 9 o'clock, and we're talking about the president's address to the nation last night at 9 p.m. in an 18-minute address, where he deflected blame for Americans' economic worries and promised that good things are happening, while also claiming victory and triumph. So we're talking about that this morning. We got a letter from Russ who says about half of Americans are heartily sick of the swill served up by the grifter-in-chief last night, and another half believe he has their interests at heart. The result is a paralysis of public policy, and only a crisis will bring the logjam. Yeah. I would ask / argue. I don't know what the definition of a crisis is. It seems like we're already in a crisis, but I don't know what more could happen that would be a crisis.
Well, I mean, some people are in crisis and some people aren't. I mean, it's fairly clear. I mean, walk outside the studio.
Right.
Right. You see people in crisis, but you drive a mile or two down the road and you see people who aren't. And that's where we're at as a society.
Yeah. And 1 in 4, I think, capital region families are 1 economic hardship away from bankruptcy.
Right.
That could be a flat tire that sends you into having to borrow, and people are relying on credit cards and payday loans. And That's the world that we all live in, but not Donald Trump. He does not live in that world.
You two very wisely took a micro level into that, where I was thinking about the crisis of democracy and the fact that we don't seem to have a working Congress or Senate, and that nothing, like, there's no legislation on the horizon that is going to be the white horse that's going to save us.
Yeah, I mean, he even was saying, we have this immigration crisis because Biden thought that he needed congressional approval to fix it. It turns out you don't need congressional approval for nearly as much as you thought that you did. And, you know, he's the only one bold enough to try to get away with everything that he's been doing over the last 11 months.
Although, to be fair, like, he's pushing the FCC and the FBI to do some wild stuff rather than, you know, talking about policies that would actually help people. He's talking about housing. He hasn't sat down with governors yet to talk about local regulations and red tape and zoning. And a lot of the building that gets done in terms of affordable housing has to do with local zoning. There's nothing the president can do about that, literally. But to your point, Lauren, is that he does have the power of persuasion, which could get that ball moving.
I was just going to say the writer's word choice of paralysis, I think, is a good one, though. I mean, I think a lot of people have said, like, this speech was the origin was sort of desperation because he feels like his poll numbers are dropping and I was looking at the New York Times this morning and they have, like, you know, they do polling aggregators of, like, the credible polls, and his approval ratings are at 43%, which is not great, but that is what they were in April. That's what they were for his almost entire first term. That's also about what Biden's were at this time. So, I mean, I think the economy is a weakness. Affordability is, like, a potential area of concern. But I also just think, like, it's incredible. His approval ratings have been incredibly resilient through a lot of crises and a lot of controversies.
The other part of that, let me ask you this, Laurel, because I find want to read a letter from Peter who says, here we go again. The media insists it is a duty to cover Trump whenever he opens his pathological lying mouth. The best thing the legacy media could do would be to refuse to cover his incoherent musings. But the media owners lack the moral courage to do so. We are all getting sick of the role the media plays in supporting this mentally ill man. I will note, for whatever it's worth, that NPR decided not to cover the speech last night. They covered it in the sense of in their news coverage and in their newscasts and so forth, but did not air it live, although they did offer a video on their website. But I still feel like I get this question all the time, I'm sure you do too, of that still the president of the United States, like, you got to cover this stuff, right? I mean, that's our job to do. And I don't, yes, I know what's being said is not true. Yes, I get that. But aren't we doing a disservice? I don't talk about this speech specifically, but in just sort of ignoring what's going on doesn't seem to be the way to go. Laurel?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think that goes back to that power to persuade. I mean, that everything the president does by nature of being president is newsworthy. I mean, people are interested in it. There's 535 members of Congress. Most people don't know who they are. And so that's not really an interesting story. But, like, I don't know, everything that the president does, where he goes for lunch, you know, does he have a pet or not? Like, this is, like, things Americans are really
He does
interested
not have
in.
A pet, and if he did, things may be better. Yes.
So I do think that it's important. I do think he wields incredible power. So what he says he's going to do, I think it's important to listen to it. That said, I think it's a good point. Like, news organizations have the choice whether to cover these or not. And they have in the past, I think, during the administration of, like, George H.W. Bush, during Bill Clinton, they have said, I'm going to give a primetime address. And the network said, no, thanks, we're not going to cover this because we don't think it's important enough to interrupt our regular programming. But here's where Trump had so much potential. I mean, not everyone covered his speech, but he is very good at getting people to pay attention to him. And that, you know, does give him a potential to, as Justin was saying, like, move the needle if he wants.
All day long, I said, I'm not watching it. I know I have to watch it for the show. I'm not watching it. I'll watch it later. I'll watch the coverage. I'm not watching it. I'm not watching it. I'm not watching it. I'm not watching it. Honey, the president's on. Quick, come here. You got to watch this. And
Next thing you know,
you can't turn away.
I mean, I think that the media is really important because, yes, we're having more coverage of that, but then after they're dissecting it and they're saying this is what was true and this is what was not true. And if you look at places that don't have freedom of media, like Russia, you might have that same speech, but then you wouldn't have all the fact checking after. So I'll take our system over the alternative.
No, I think that's a great point, because you get, we ran into this with the we run into this every day, but with the Rob Reiner comments, you know, you feel like you shouldn't even give them air, any oxygen whatsoever. And yet I do think it's important to realize what we're dealing with.
But I do think that
not that we don't know
better coverage. I don't think no coverage is the answer. I think better coverage is, I think the discussion about public policy and actual legislation is still mostly in print.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the big issues, is that let's not treat consumers like they're stupid. And instead of talking heads, let's put people who actually talk policy onto legacy media rather than people who care about policy going to print. Bring policy to everyday people and treat them like they actually have a stake in what happens.
That's what we're trying to do in this show.
I know. I think that is a brilliant point. And I think the other thing that could help the coverage would be, and this is hard to do in most media formats, is historical, putting it into historical context. And I was just thinking, I taught a class on Congress and the presidency this fall, and the president of Hartwick College, Jim Mullen, who is a student of the presidency, came in and gave this guest lecture. And his topic that he chose was presidential leadership during times of crisis. And he picked three case studies to focus on. And he talked about LBJ's address to Congress 5 days after the assassination of President Kennedy. He talked about Ronald Reagan's address to the nation in the wake of the Challenger explosion. And then he talked about George W. Bush's address a few days after 9/11. And he was just, you know, and all of that was history to the students, none of whom were born at 9/11. So this was really, so they were like, it was great. They were on the edge of their seats learning all this new information. And but he made the point that, like, he had them listen to clips of the speeches and about how they all, from both parties, they were reassuring the nation. They were talking about national unity, really, really at pains, beautiful language to bring the nation together, to remind us of what our core democratic values are, why it is, you know, important to, you know, live in a democracy. And they also had a lot of humility in them, saying, like, I can't do this. This is, like, I need you. I need the nation. We need to pull together. And this is where I see there's, like, a really lost opportunity in Trump's address last night. I mean, and the interesting thing is President Mullen didn't mention Trump's name at all. He basically put it out here. Here's, like, pretty effective ways to deal with a nation in crisis, and just let the students take that framework and, you know, apply it themselves. And what we saw last night, there was no national unity. There was no appeal to our core democratic values. There was no humility. And you just wonder, there's been times where Trump has hit some of those notes. You just wonder, what if he'd gone out there last night and talked about that, learned from history, and, like, talked about the, you know, how other presidents have sought to reassure the nation during tough times. And I just think it was an opportunity. I think that would have gotten a lot of positive reaction and surprised some people, maybe moved some people, but that's not what happened.
Ashley?
No, that's great points. I wish that he would do that too. He just has never shown the ability to do that. He divides us. He does not bring us together. There have been national tragedies on a weekly basis, and it's always, he uses it as a point to divide us further as opposed to bringing us together. He did preview in the speech last night that next year is the 250 revolutionary anniversary. We'll also be hosting the World Cup. The Olympics will be coming to Los Angeles shortly, and he will be president during those what are usually not just national unity moments, but also global unity moments. And I already have residual embarrassment for those upcoming events. Those are events that I look forward to, our family looks forward to, everybody looks forward to those things, and this will be our spokesperson on the global stage, and that just makes me deeply sad.
We'll take a break, and we'll leave it at sadness, and then we'll take a break, and we'll return, and we'll try to gussy up after that. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us, Ashley Dittus. Laurel Elder, Anna Markowitz, and Justin Patch make up our group, and we thank you for being with us. Deborah writes to us and says, how dare Congress leave for winter break when they have barely returned from a lengthy taxpayer-funded vacation? How can they leave without, one, taking back their power and stopping the tariffs? Two, stopping the Venezuela boat attacks? Three, getting help for the millions of Americans facing the loss of their health care? It's irrelevant what demented nonsense Trump is spewing. The House and Senate are causing almost all of our national chaos by abdicating their responsibilities, and that from Deborah. We then go to this. Ross. Well, Joe, you finally did it. I've listened to the roundtable for over 20 years. Today is the first time I have to disagree with you.
Uh-oh. The first time in 20 years. That's a good track record.
It was going so well there for a while. I blame the media for giving Trump the microphone he has. He should have been ignored 15 years ago. When media did cover him, they should have discredited him on every subject. However, the media did not challenge him and conversely gave him that platform he now enjoys indiscriminately. Ross, let me just say, I think we probably agree with each other more than my brief comments before would indicate. My argument, if you're making the argument, which I think you are, that during the 2015-2016 campaign that too much media time was spent on Trump, and that people were giving him a free ride and playing every single speech that he did over and over and over again, then yes, I agree with that entirely. And not covering the other candidates in that election. Absolutely. And the fact that even in the latest campaign of that happening again over and over again, I completely agree with you. My issue is, and I think we're probably like, I think we can come to peace on this, Ross, which is, I just, no matter who the president of the United States is, you got to cover the president of the United States. And now how you cover it and the way you cover it and the fact that we're spending this time and talking about it and fact checking and so forth, I think is important. But I really do. I mean, I think you can't just sort of let it go and forget it and put it to the side, because it's there. It's I know he wants to be the biggest thing in the room, and on most days he is. So,
well, if I can make a point here,
yes,
to go back to what I said about better
coverage.
You're
not going to take Ross's side, are you?
No, about better coverage. Like, I know John Kasich is boring. There's nothing interesting about seeing him speak. But if you actually had people who examined policy, it would have made for something interesting. Likewise, if you had people who actually examined policy talking about Trump from the standpoint of policy rather than the, oh, wow, this dude is crazy, let's put him on the air because he gets a lot of eyeballs, maybe some of the things about Trump's major business failings would have actually come out, some of the stuff about his rhetoric, people could have said, hey, look, what he thinks about the economy, about immigration, about education flies in the face of actual evidence. Maybe that would come out instead of like, wow, let's do this because it gets eyeballs.
Mm-hmm. I love what you just said for many reasons, but following the 2016 election, we had the opportunity of having John Kasich on the panel, and he was with us for an hour, and he was deadly boring. I was so excited to have him because I thought, oh, well, here's a Republican. Here's somebody who can sort of bring us to – and I – oh my God! that is a very, very good point.
Hey, we're learning Bourne is good right now.
Yeah, well, that's fine too. I'm okay with that. Calm things down. Janet says Donald Trump is president of the United States. Americans and the entire world need to hear and experience his thoughts, preferences, thinking to more accurately evaluate him. And I guess that was all I was saying. And so thank you, Janet, and peace to Ross. I do think we ultimately agree with one another on this. Richard says headlines are what most people glance at for their news. The problem with the news is the headlines. The headlines should state Trump lies again or the president bullies another country. The president wants children to go hungry. The president breaks the law again. Instead, we have lukewarm headlines that do not challenge what the hell is really going on. And I would say, as my friend and colleague on the panel, Ira Fussfeld, reminds me and our listeners all the time, that you don't say media, you say some in the media. Because I think that is accurate. Some in the media. All right. Let's go to, I thought we had another letter. We do. I turned my TV off at 9 p.m. sharp last night. I read a good book. I mute him when a program runs a clip of him as well. We do not have to tune in to that craziness that is Melinda. And you don't.
It's you do great, not have to. Great mental health practice that we should all take. We'd be feeling so much more zen.
No doubt. Ricky says, if the media is so terrible to be airing the president's speech and you don't like it, you know, you can turn the media off. Blaming the media for our society's problems is silly and, quite frankly, childish. President Trump and his movement blame the media for everything. That from Ricky. All right. We have about 5 minutes before we go to the top of the hour. Oh, a couple letters here. Paul says, you assume most people are interested in what the president says or does. I find many people are oblivious to Trump or Biden or any commander in chief. They're so focused on their families, their jobs, their school activities, etc., that they remain in their personal and professional silos and focus on whatever their social media algorithms give them. Well, that's true. But that doesn't mean, I mean, if you're not a sports fan and you don't listen to sports talk radio, that's fine. But I think when we're talking about our democracy, it's important that at least be there. And if you choose to bail out of it, that's fine.
I mean, that's why they interrupted Survivor, is to try to, get the folks that maybe aren't looking to pay attention to this.
My first reaction when I heard that news was, oh my God, that show's been on for 30 years.
I didn't 30 know what
years.
Going.
Yeah, I mean, it was like 30 years. Yeah. And they said it was their season finale. I said, oh, they had a season this year? I didn't even, well.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, the other thing they cut into was Rob Lowe hosting The Floor. And, that's a thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I mean, Rob Lowe's been around a while, too.
Rob Lowe
has
a game show.
But I do think there's something very valuable about listening to elected officials, the president or others, speak for an extended period of time rather than, I mean, so much of our news is like tiny, tiny sound bites and then commentary wrapped around it. And as one of the writers said, people will often seek out commentators who are going to say things that confirm their pre-existing beliefs. So just to sit down and listen to 18 minutes yourself or to listen to a State of the Union address, I think there's something valuable about that. I think that you end up hearing different things than you hear when you just, you know, listen to the news coverage of it.
I don't endorse this comment, but I did giggle. Jimmy Kimmel, during his monologue last night, said that President Trump preempted the first 15 minutes of the floor. And I feel that the president should be mopping the floor, not preempting it.
Yeah, I did laugh at that.
I giggled.
Yeah,
I giggled. All right, let's see. We'll move on here to other topics, and then we'll when we come back, we'll dig right in and talk about all of this more details about what. We're about to bring up, but one is that Dan Bongino announced that he is leaving the FBI deputy director job in January. When I first heard this news, I thought, oh, well, this must have something to do with what's going on at Brown. This must have something to do with some sort of kerfuffle between Kash Patel and Dan Bongino. And this must have something to do with the overall running of the FBI. No. Dan Bongino, who has been a controversial character in this novel, announced that he will leave his job after what has been termed a tumultuous tenure by the Washington Post, in which he helped oversee major shifts in the Bureau's resources and dramatic dismissals of experienced agents. He has decided, President Trump said, that he feels that he can do more good by returning to his job as a conservative podcaster. We'll let that sink in. We'll talk about it. We welcome your comments. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we will do all of that after this short break. You know, during these breaks, we get to learn so much about our panelists. I get to learn about them. They get to learn about me. And we were having this discussion, oddly, about real IDs. And we were talking about whether you get one, you don't get one, or if you're late in getting one and all that stuff. And then that perennial wonderful conversation of enhanced ID and real ID and when you bring your passport and what you can do and what you can't do and so forth. So we were talking about this, and in the deployment of that conversation, I mentioned that my license expires on my birthday, which is 12/31, New Year's Eve. Anna Markowitz chimes in with, oh, my God, well, high five. My birthday is on January 1st.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's very, very cool. That's really right. Then Justin pipes in and says, well, my birthday is on the 30th.
We're just going to pass a relay baton between the three of us. And I win because I'm the last one.
Yes, yes. So you're right.
So
yeah,
I like winning, mm-hmm. so I support this.
You totally win. And right. and as Anna said, in great triumph, I would say, Capricorns unite.
We're the best.
Yeah. Yeah. Just good. So learn something, and I thank you all for that. When are your birthdays, Anna?
Laurel, sorry.
Okay.
August 31st. Not
all right. Yeah. Oh, well, that's my brother's birthday.
Okay,
that's my
there you go. Birthday. I like it. It's like the bittersweet end of summer.
Labor Day.
You know?
Yeah.
So nice. I think it's okay.
January 30th, I'm turning 40, so it's a milestone for me next year.
Oh, my God. How are you handling it? I did not do well turning 40.
You know, it's whatever.
Okay.
It's fine.
All right.
What do they say? 40's the new 30, or yeah, they're just scaling everything down.
BS,
yeah,
for
sure. I mean, I do have a toddler, so I feel it in my lower back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. Well,
I did say 40 is the old age of youth, and 40 is the youth of old age.
Yeah, I'm right in the middle.
There you go.
Like I'm no longer. I was at a Democratic committee meeting, and they were talking about all the young people, but I've been around so long. That they're like, yeah, and she's under 45, and I'm like, Me too.
Okay, so before we left you all for the break and our discussion about our birthdays, Dan Bongino was mentioned. He has announced that he is leaving the administration, leaving the FBI as the deputy director, and he'll be leaving that job in January, which is just a very short few days away. I want to thank my fellow Americans for the privilege to serve you, he said in a social media post announcing his departure. He will return to his job as a conservative podcaster. Bongino, the second most powerful person in the FBI, left Washington for the year more than a week ago and said he would not be returning to the agency's headquarters. So he's done. Mm-hmm. I think he's done. And the desk is cleared out. And he had previously told colleagues that his last official day at the Bureau would be in January. But he's all, for all practical purposes, done. And in a social media post, he thanked Trump. He thanked Pam Bondi, the attorney general. He thanked FBI Director Kash Patel for the opportunity to serve with purpose. Patel, in a statement, called Bongino the best partner I could have asked for in helping restore this FBI. Patel and Bongino have shifted FBI resources to immigration enforcement, sinking morale at an agency that typically attracts law enforcement officials who are trained to work on more complex investigations. They've also pushed out seasoned veterans within the Bureau with years of experience in national security and public corruption probes, as one of the stories that we talked about yesterday from the Boston Globe indicated, that Kash Patel, the head of the FBI, is coming under a great deal of scrutiny because of his handling of the ongoing investigation into the shooting at Brown University and how many who are working with him directly feel that he is not up to that task. I turn this over to our panel. Who would like to start?
My favorite line in that article was, people used to pay me for my opinion. And now with the FBI, it just seems to be really focused on investigation and fact. And that's obviously just not where he thrived. And so he's going back to opinion and focusing less on facts. So I wish you well. Best of luck. Au revoir.
When I worked in television, I had the great privilege of making up stories, and now I have to tell the truth. Damn it!
Oh, it's such a bummer.
Yeah, it is a bummer. I didn't.
I think
you'd see that coming.
I do think it makes the point that the skill set that it takes to be a performer, to be a conservative podcaster and get a lot of people to tune in and listen to you, that's a very different skill set than what you need at the FBI in a leadership position, and really probably any government agency. They're very different. Yet Donald Trump has picked a lot of people who have, you know, that former skill set to lead a lot of the government agencies. And I think you end up with a lot of chaos.
You know, I say this from experience. I say this from deep decades and decades of experience doing this job. But at no time in my life, in my 58 years on this planet as of December 31st, have I ever been anywhere, whether it be in a hospital or at the FBI or at the IRS or at a Department of Education, where somebody said, oh my God, we need a talk show host. Like, it doesn't, right?
I mean, You'd be so ready, though.
But yeah. You're not, that's just not, that's not the skill set. That's different. And I don't know why we ever thought that was going to work. I think it was Ellie Honig was on CNN last night and was saying, look, you know, this was doomed from the beginning, mm-hmm. Both Kash Patel and Bongino, and it experience counts or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy from the sidelines to talk about a government that does nothing and talk about how you don't see any changes, you don't see any results, all that from government work, except that it's a lot more difficult than people imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Dan Bongino was finding that out, that it's a lot easier to stand back and throw stones and say how people aren't working for you. And it's a lot more difficult to deliver results, like real, actual results for people, mm-hmm. than he could have ever imagined.
And it's not fun.
No. Yeah. No, it's hard work. It's hard work.
As someone who works in the current government.
As a lifelong public servant, this story makes me so happy. I've also worked with people in law enforcement and that culture, and people with the FBI working from the ground up and rising through the ranks and not making yourself the story, mm-hmm. but making the work of the agency your mission is not what Bongino or Kash Patel do. I mean, Kash Patel has bungled the Brown shooting this weekend, putting out information before it was verified. The Charlie Kirk shooting, same thing, because he wants to be a star on social media, and that's more fun than running an agency. When Bongino had to get, you know, co-directorship with the Missouri, I think he's from. So that was the tell. Also, the the inner drama between him and Pam Bondi, the fighting that they've had over the summer. Maybe that was fun for him. I know a little bit of conflict is always fun when you're in these positions, particularly in the Trump administration. But doing these jobs is hard work. He's a conspiracy theorist. He'll go back to doing that. Maybe a little bit harder since he was on the inside and he's going back to the outside. Kind of hard to say that someone killed Jeffrey Epstein when you relaunch the investigation into it. So I love to see it. Bye-bye. Go back to Florida with your knickknacks. And I guess the sad part is that he will continue to mislead people that tune into his podcast. But that is a problem. We talked about media the last segment. I'm concerned with these podcasts that are just saying whatever they want. TikTok, it spills over into that. That's where people, young men, are getting their news now, and that should concern everybody deeply.
But he did say the quiet powder aloud, right? He said, I got paid to lie, and so I did. Mm-hmm. And I have some questions about whether his brand is just busted just because that sound clip is out there and he seemed really unapologetic about it. And it only happened a week or two ago? If that had happened a year ago, I think people would have forgotten it. But I think it happened so recently that I'm not sure what his stock is worth anymore.
I mean, it's a great point. And at what point you still have an audience? But I just want to go back to what Ashley said. There was a story that we won't cover it, but I don't really quite understand it all. But the Candace Owens, Erica Kirk kerfuffle. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the widow of Charlie Kirk is in a fight with Candace Owens, who was close with Kirk and now has spoken out in some ways against him, and so now those two are fighting. But what it does, and they're meeting privately and trying to iron things out. But what it does talk about is that this kind of one-upmanship, especially with someone like Candace Owens, who has a large audience, who is, but everything is, it's just. It's so irresponsible what they're saying. It's not true, and it seems to be the general media. Some in the media seem to be more interested in sort of the fight between the two, as opposed to the damage that's being done in general by this by these podcasts and the audience that they have. I mean, that's the thing, is that people are listening. So I hope you're right, Justin, but I don't know. If you have somebody out there who is throwing the bombs, I don't know. That's what people seem to want.
Well, even if I'm right, it doesn't matter because someone took Dan Bongino's place.
Yeah.
That's the sad thing.
Totally. Yes. Yeah, even if you get rid of one, there's going to be another one that pops up. Like Alex Jones, when he was going through his divorce proceedings, was like, well, I didn't actually believe any of the things I was saying. And that, I think, did hurt his reputation, rightfully so, in my opinion. But yeah, it's not like there aren't conservative podcasts that have popped up to take his spot.
Every time I see him now, I guess he still does a show, but every time I see him, he's doing the show from his car.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Yeah. I I have nothing else
more
than that.
All those fines he had to pay.
Yeah,
he lives in
just,
his car now.
Yeah, I think I would love to do the show in my car. I don't know. All right, we have other things to talk about, a lot going on. And I would like to talk about the boat strike video. And Pete Hegseth, the Pentagon released has released plenty of video clips that saw American missiles blowing boats suspected of carrying drugs out of the water. But the double tap strike on September 2nd is being kept very much under wraps. This is by our friend and great reporter David Sanger from The New York Times. One of the many oddities of the huge buildup of American forces off Venezuela. When I say friend, by the way, I mean that he's a listener and lives in our region part-time, and he's nice to us. So one of the many oddities of the huge buildup of American forces off Venezuela is the speed at which the Pentagon has released short clips of what it has identified as drug boats being struck and destroyed by American missiles, part deterrence, part bravado, and to many legal scholars questioning the legality of the operation, part evidence of extrajudicial killings. So it was striking that on Tuesday, just as the Pentagon released three more videos bringing the known death toll on the boats to 95, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced there was one the public would never, ever see. It is the video of the now-famous second strike on the boat in September that killed two survivors clinging to the remains of an overturned vessel. We're not going to release a top-secret, full, unedited video of that to the general public, he told reporters after a classified Senate hearing, citing longstanding Department of War policy. I assume as longstanding as the name Department of War. It would hardly be the first time a national security was invoked by the government to withhold something that might prove embarrassing or even legally incriminating. Some members of Congress who have seen the full video have called it shocking, while others describe it as grotesque. Mr. Hegseth's decision, weeks after President Trump said he had no problem with releasing the video, will need to backtrack as a glimpse into the depth of the administration's concern that becoming too transparent about what is happening on the high seas could turn the American public against the strikes. Mr. Hegseth's critics argue it suggests a cover-up underway. Laurel.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking about this article in combination with the one we were just talking about, just showing once again, like, the policy, the actions seem chaotic in many ways. And I think, you know, the term of Bongino, very short, very chaotic. This also seems like not a well thought out policy that, you know, releasing some videos, not releasing others. It seems it just makes the public just wonder what's happening. You know, this selective transparency. And once again, you wonder, like, I mean, I think many people brought this up, but does Pete Hegseth have the skills, the experience, the ability to be leading the Defense Department or Department of War, whatever you want to call it? And probably not. He probably doesn't. And I think this is what we're saying, sort of the downstream consequences of putting people in these positions of leadership who don't have the experience and the competence. You have this sort of chaos. And so we're 11 months in now to Trump's second term. And I just feel like this is what we're going to have for three more years and 1 month. We're going to have a lot of, like, there's no reason to think anything's going to change. Maybe some people are saying, oh, maybe Pete Hegseth is going to leave the administration. Maybe he'll be the first person to leave. Dan Bongino is leaving. But there's just going to be new people like this. Like, Trump is sort of an agent of chaos, and then he chooses people to be his top leaders who are also sort of agents of chaos. And I think that's what we're going to have for the next 3 years and 1 month. So I think we just, I mean, I'm not saying we just say, well, what can we do? I think you still need to hold tight to your democratic principles. I think you need to stay paying attention to the news and following it. But I also think this is sort of the expected outcome in many ways.
Well, this story always has me thinking bigger picture than, you know, this. Yes, they made an error and should not have done a double tap. And the videos, I'm sure, are appalling. They are using this, like, fake narrative of this is a war on drugs to cover up that they want a regime change. And, you know, if they said, hey, We are attacking Venezuela because we want our oil rights back. That would not be a very positive public narrative that people would be like, yeah, oil rights, overthrow that government of another country. So they're using fentanyl, and they're saying, in Trump's address, he was like, oh, drug imports by boat has fallen by, 98% or something, some large 90s number. That's not how drugs come into our country. They come in through passenger vehicles going through the southern border. So it's a talking point, and, it's another disappointment.
Yeah, particularly the fentanyl. Well, first of all, Congress needs to do something, get to work and do something about these strikes. 95 people, at least 95, have been killed, likely illegally. The reason this video is not coming out is because it's so particularly gruesome and is bad PR. But they are also cutting funding for drug intervention programs, mm-hmm. for treatment programs, talking about cutting to DEA and ATF. Like, there are people who are struggling in this country with drug addiction, and this is the answer to under false pretenses. It's very disrespectful to people who have struggled with drugs and family members that their crisis is being used for political strongman military operations. I did just out myself as turning 40 next month. I have lost multiple high school classmates to the fentanyl crisis, which for me, knowing people who have lost family members and myself classmates, it's just like with the war on Gaza. I don't love that my taxpayer dollars are going towards this kind of brutality and the international stage.
I mean, we've seen pieces of this before where images that the government doesn't want. We think about caskets coming back from Iraq,
right. mm-hmm.
in 2002. The same thing went on with the Vietnam War when the Johnson administration and Kennedy before him didn't want people to know how many young men were getting killed. It's disingenuous. It's particularly hurtful for people who have lost family members. And in this particular case, it shows the callousness and the lies that are being perpetuated. I think we've seen this over and over again. And you hear the contradictions. Pete Hegseth saying, we're not going to release classified video. Well, if every single other one wasn't classified, then why is this one classified? Huh? Like, mm-hmm. It doesn't hold up. It doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And I agree. Congress needs to do something just to compel this and put it into the light.
It's also, and I said this yesterday, but it's hard to take this argument seriously coming from the guy who brought in a reporter on a strike in Yemen and mm-hmm. also included his family on purpose and then talk about the delicate nature of security. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Again, talk show host running a huge bureaucracy.
Yeah,
maybe a little underweight for this one, too.
Yeah.
No one saw that coming.
Duly admitted. No, right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. All right. JC says, growing up in the 60s and 70s, I've long been a critic of the FBI for lots of reasons. Incompetence was not one of them. Since then, I have worked closely with an alphabet soup of federal agencies throughout my career. My respect for the professionals in those positions has grown regardless of the political overseers involved in guiding these agencies. Bongino is the first taste of blood in the water. That from JC. We go to Vincent. Love or hate the FBI, the individuals who have worked there are considered to be the best mm-hmm. of the best in the law enforcement profession. Agencies across the country send their exceptional people to Quantico for training. Patel and Mangino are an embarrassment and an affront to all of the men and women who work to protect us. Vincent, that's an excellent point. It's one that we made yesterday on the show in the article that we were talking about in regards to Kash Patel coming under fire for his handling of the Brown University shooting, that all local law enforcement officials who were working on that had nothing but high praise for the agents on the ground from the FBI who they were working with, and only wished that it would, that level of professionalism would continue up the
up the ranks. So great point, and one that I think we did talk about a little bit yesterday. Then we go to Barbara. No, maybe no one ever did say, oh my God, we need a talk show host out loud. However, we do. My ongoing argument about needed professions. Yes, doctors and nurses and EMTs being one, and teachers and truck drivers having been one, and so on, are more directly needed. But talk show hosts, performers, musicians, being associated with musical theater for over 50 years, artists, and on, in the not directly necessary professions are also needed. They are needed for our mental health and our quality of life. And yes, very much needed. Well, that's a lovely letter, and I thank you so much for that. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have another half hour of this program. We will wrap up, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Ashley Didis is here. Anna Markowitz, Justin Patch, and Laurel Elder. So I think this will be fun to talk about. I hope this is fun to talk about. There's a new study out revealing how Taylor Swift reflects America's deepest political and gender divides. It's a newly published article in Social Science Quarterly revealing how attitudes toward global pop icon Taylor Swift have become a lens through which to view the political and social divisions shaping the United States. The article is Mirror Ball Politics, How Taylor Swift Reflects America's Partisan and Gender Divides. Political scientist Laurel Elder of Hartwick College, our guest this morning, is one of the authors of this study to analyze national data to examine how partisanship and age and gender attitudes shape public perceptions of Taylor Swift. For those of us who say that we talk too much about the day-to-day politics and not enough about pop culture, both two things together, here we go. I just want to know, like, what's happening in your life that you think, oh, that's what I want to, that's what I want to look into?
I will tell you. So this all starts during the pandemic when I was slowly losing my mind. And the only thing that kept me going was that Taylor Swift released Folklore and then Evermore, two albums in 2020. And they were like my emotional lifeline. And then fast forward a couple years later and my daughter's turning 13 and I think, we have to get to the Eras Tour, no matter what. And we did. We saw it in Philadelphia in May of 2023. And it was amazing. But of course, I'm not just a Taylor Swift fan. I'm also a political scientist who studies public opinion and gender. So the whole time I'm at the concert, I'm thinking, this is just amazing. I'm like, everybody knows Taylor Swift. Everyone has feelings about Taylor Swift. And there's all these reactions to her. So I'm like, I'm wondering, like, I want to get a hold of public opinion data about Taylor Swift and see what people think about her and what the determinants of public opinion are and what this tells us about the state of American politics and society. And that's what I did.
I apologize for interrupting, but just the fact that there is data on that indicates what a big deal she is.
Well,
right?
I mean, here's the thing. My colleagues and I were at the American Political Science Association conference, which hosts about 5,000 political scientists once a year. And there was this firm called Verisite, a polling firm, and they had a booth. And they said, if you come by our booth, you can get a question on our national survey, because it can cost $150,000 to do a national survey. And so we'd been talking about this idea but it was only one question per person. So we had to get a group of researchers together. And we got on a question about Taylor Swift, a question about hostile sexism, actually a couple questions. And and so that's how we did it. So that was the triumph.
So the term mirror ball politics, what is that?
Okay,
what does that mean?
Your listeners who are Taylor Swift fans will know that that is the name of one of her songs.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. That's the argument that we're making in this piece, that public opinion about Taylor Swift actually is a mirror to some of these gender and partisan divides in our society. And we just talk about how views of her reflect our deep you know, polarization along party lines. It reflects the gender gap, particularly among young Americans, and it also shows the really strong role of hostile sexism in our society, that women who are prominent in cultural or political spheres face this. It's a really real force in American politics.
Is that overt sexism based on her gender or based on her success or both?
Well, I mean, this term hostile sexism is, you know, researchers have said there's actually different kinds of sexism. And hostile sexism is the idea that people are resentful of they think women have gotten too much power, and they think that women have gained power in society at the cost of men. So women are making gains, but this means losses for men. So there's different questions that kind of tap this, like some things like, do women complain too much about things at work, being treated unfairly at work? That's one of the measures, for example. And anyway, so it really is. I think it's both, but it's particularly we see it as being a strong force about women who have positions of power. And here you have Taylor Swift. She's very successful. She is, you know, really working hard at, you know, owning her own music and being, you know, autonomous in control of her own music. And I think this, so a lot of people will say, I don't like Taylor Swift's music. And I think a lot of people just don't like her music. But some of it is because there's resentment against powerful women in our society.
Well, you don't have to like everything, certainly, but it is interesting in the study of how, when it comes to Gen Z, it also shows this this gender divide.
Yeah,
and that's fascinating to me because that's something obviously that's being passed down.
Yeah, yeah. So what we see is that there's been a gender gap in American politics. Pretty much consistently since 1980, a pretty modest size with women being a little bit more liberal and democratic than men. But a lot of polls have shown that it's quite large among young Americans, under 30 is usually how they define it. And that was on display in the 2024 election. We saw, you know, women being pretty progressive and young men drifting in a more conservative direction. And that same gender divide is apparent in terms of views on Taylor Swift as well. We see a huge partisan gap, too. That's one of our big, I mean, that might be is not surprising, but like Democrats tend to like Taylor Swift. Republicans tend not to like Taylor Swift. And to some extent, you know, pop music used to be a place where people could come together. Republicans, Democrats enjoy the same music, have some fun together. And what we're seeing now, I mean, Taylor Swift is just one example where, like, people, it's like a marker of your political identity now. And there's, you know, fewer and fewer common spaces where we as Americans can come together and, you know, find common ground.
I've seen this woman perform twice, and I've gone with my nieces both times, and the power that she has over the audience and them and what they see in her and what is reflected I've never seen anything like it. It is so profound and really cool, quite frankly. But I did notice during the campaign, this past campaign, where there was this little kerfuffle over, you know, her backing a candidate and who she was going to back politically, that seemed to put more pressure on her than anyone else would have had of being a pop music star.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things there. I mean, I think I framed it kind of negative that there's like this, you know, hostile sexism and some people that's driving some people to not like Taylor Swift. But you point out the impact that she's had on, did you say your nieces?
Yes.
Young women. I think it's been very powerful and very positive, making them feel confident and feeling like they can do things and be independent. There is I've done research on role model effects, and I think it's a positive thing. There in many ways. But also, the pressure is on her because she has reached such a, I mean, she was well known, but then with the Eras tour, it's just like went to a different stratosphere. It's like Beatles, it's like Elvis. There's like when she had I'm sure you saw the news coverage of this, when she had a concert in a city, it would actually affect the economy of that city. You know, it had such a powerful impact. So I think few people reach that level of fame. And so with that, I do think comes a lot of responsibility. And so I think when she endorses a candidate, it comes under a lot of scrutiny. That said, I would say her music overall is it's not very political music at all. I mean, I think some people are disappointed in that. But, you know, and she comes from country music. She's gone a lot of different genres. So it's just like her music itself is not that political. But yet she's become a political symbol. Yeah.
Can I just put one note in on Taylor
Swift?
Well, I'm going to talk about the other part of pop culture that men love is football. And that she is engaged to a guy who's a Hall of Fame tight end.
Yeah.
And yet in that relationship, she's the big cheese.
Yes.
So if you are a guy who's into traditional masculinity, mm-hmm. That's rough. You would think if you're potentially Hall of Fame tight end with two Super Bowl rings, that you would be the guy. Except that, no, that's not the case. And I think that twist adds a little something to what Laurel was saying.
I think early in that 100%. In that relationship, people were saying, "Well, all they do in the television is show her in the luxury box." And one of the commentators, I believe it was Jim Nance, said, "Well, we have found that when we don't do that, we get so many complaints from both women but men who are very upset that they're not seeing how Taylor is reacting to a given play on the field." I mean, it's interesting to watch. The other thing, doesn't it also, and this is where I can potentially get into trouble, but isn't it, because this certainly isn't, I don't think sexist, it's just true, but someone to reach that level of success and not be a train wreck. Like, I mean, doesn't that say a lot to, I mean, she herself does an amazing job, but she has also managed incredibly well. I mean, that is a business, and it is a very, very, very astute. They do it extremely well, which I think often is a rarity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's what, you know, I liked her music, went to the show, and it was just phenomenal. I mean, we've all gone to concerts. They usually start late and all this. She's just started. She had a countdown clock. It started exactly when it was supposed to start.
Yeah.
On the note. I mean, she did all these costume changes, but did them within like 45 seconds. So, you were just never, waiting. It was so professional. It was so amazing. But I know people who have worked on my cousin has friends who's worked on tours, and the people working on her tour like love it. Everyone wanted to work on Taylor's tour because they are treated so well professionally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they said it's not like that on the other tours. It's like she is a good business person, without a doubt. She knows how to run a very large and complex organization.
Yeah, I saw Taylor Swift in this tour, and I saw a Coldplay, and I was struck by both of those artists. Of being able to have 70,000 people in a stadium and make you not feel like you're a part of a group of 70,000 people, like actually speaking to you and having it be a very intimate experience, which seems to be an impossible thing to do, and yet they do it.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll say about Taylor Swift in sports is that the whole there's an incredible amount of pressure both in 2020. And 2024 about like when is Taylor Swift going to endorse somebody? Is she going to endorse Kamala Harris? All that sort of stuff. At the same time, you've got the shut up and dribble stuff in post George Floyd, right? And so I find it interesting that like there's a whole wing of people that are like, if you're an entertainer, just shut up and entertain. Except that like if you're Taylor Swift, like if you're not participating politically, you're doing something wrong. And I think, having done music and seen what it takes for people to succeed, you don't have a lot of extra time. And so the expectation for her to be political is, to me, it's like people want to hear their values spoken through the biggest microphone. And for a lot of people, Taylor Swift is the biggest microphone. Mm-hmm. And that reflects something about how small people feel. And to Laurel's point about democratic values, about how people don't feel like there are democratic values because their voice doesn't matter. And so you take recourse to the biggest microphone saying what you want to say because you feel like nobody's listening to you.
And for the candidate, for that person who's being endorsed, they obviously want that audience, right? I mean, they want a piece of that pie.
Although studies have shown that celebrity endorsements count for very little. But yeah. I think it does make people feel better when they hear their thoughts reflected on the largest possible stages, which I think is just a sad moment in society when we're dependent on somebody else to be our own mouthpieces.
I do wonder if, like, there was a shift in her listeners after she endorsed Kamala Harris, because I was actually a little surprised that she did, because she was dating this football star. It seemed like she was kind of trying to, like, bridge the gap, like, bring everybody together. We can all love Taylor Swift. And I bet there was some blowback after she endorsed and did a whole, like, I'm a cat lady too moment. Mm-hmm. But on a personal note, this makes me really want to talk to my two teen and preteen boys about why they don't like Taylor Swift. Before, I thought it was just because it was like a lady pop star. Like, I don't expect you to listen to Ani DiFranco either. But, like, is this like a gender statement? Because ladies are bosses too, and you need to be okay with that. So
check on the boys.
I know.
Well, I mean, what's interesting when we were researching this piece, because I was like, trying to find what other articles have been written about, like, partisanship and music tastes and things like that. And the gender. And this was my point that this may or may not surprise people, but if you, like, ask, like, a guy, like, show me your playlist, it's like almost all men on the playlist. Yeah. And if you ask a woman, show me your playlist, it's like 50-50. Mm-hmm. And I think you see the same with, like, books people read, who are the authors you're reading, things like this. And so that's just like a broader question. Like, what is going on in society that men listen to overwhelmingly male artists and women listen to both women and men? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, your sons are reflecting broader trends, something that's going on.
You say in the report, popular entertainment used to be a common space where Americans could come together and have some fun. Those shared spaces are shrinking, and with it, the opportunity for connection across partisan divides.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we're seeing this, I mean, in terms of so many facets of, like, you know, what car you drive, what kind of clothes you wear, what kind of neighborhoods you live in, and just this kind of, I mean, Robert Putnam, you know, probably a lot of people are familiar with him, a Harvard political scientist, and just talked about Bowling Alone. It's just like there's these spaces where people with different views would come together, whether it was the bowling alley or the Taylor Swift concert or whatever it might be, are just shrinking among us. And I think that's a sign. So once again, it's like Taylor Swift didn't cause these divisions, but she is, like, reflecting them back to us in a particularly powerful way.
Well, I think, like, the death of monoculture in our society has really fostered that environment. Except for Taylor Swift has been the only person in the last 15, 20 years that has punched through that. The internet has sort of siloed us off. We used to all watch the series finale of a TV show all at the same time because that's when it was on TV. Mm-hmm. Now with streaming, you can just pick and choose when you're going to watch it, when it's convenient for you. As a fellow Swifty, I am now obsessed with you, and I would love to read this study. This is something, you know, these kinds of studies are what sticks with people. I studied international relations, and the Big Mac Index is one of the few things I remember from college. When you connect it to things that young people care about, or just, you know, all people care about, I think that that's what will stick with people, and the message is so awesome. You are awesome. That is really cool.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up the show right after this.
Support comes from Autobahn Service, Route 7, Sheffield, Massachusetts, providing service, repair, and diagnosis of modern European imports, specializing in Volkswagen, Audi, Mercedes, Land Rover, Porsche, and BMW, AutobahnTechnic.com. The Meyer Law Firm Latham, woman-owned, providing counsel without judgment for estate planning and administration. It's not just business, it is personal. The M-E-I-E-R LawFirm.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the show. We're going to talk more about Taylor Swift. It's very nice to have you all with us, and we welcome you to the tail end of the program here. We just have about 5 minutes left. You were making an interesting point at the break, Justin.
Well, what I found sort of anecdotally just among my colleagues and sort of coworkers is that millennial guys are way more okay with Taylor Swift than younger men.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be what Laurel's article looking at younger men seems to play that out, that she becomes a much more divisive, I hate to say that she's a divisive figure, but one that is exemplifies certain gender divides among younger men, mm-hmm. not among men who are in their late 30s and early 40s.
Right.
Yeah, and I do think this feeds into this broader conversation that's been having when we saw young men drifting, towards Republican partisan identification and voting for Trump in larger numbers in 2024. The manosphere, you know, the idea that there's a lot of conservative podcasters out there that young men seem particularly drawn to, and there's some evidence coming out now that like young men have more like traditional attitudes, or becoming more religious, have more, you know, in terms of gender roles, more traditional than millennial and older generations. So I think you're maybe seeing that reflected, and your comment speaks to that directly.
I mean, I sort of wonder how much of that has to do with economic anxiety. I mean, guys who are slightly younger than I, most of them have figured out their careers and they're sort of on their way. And so the threat of competing for a job with a woman who, you know, has the same credentials as you is much, much, much less of an issue for older, sort of early middle-aged guys than it is for 22-year-olds.
Right. Ken writes to us and says, I think there's two important things to consider in the political divide with Taylor Swift. One, of course, Republicans hate her. She's a smart, independent, successful woman who is willing to take a stand, speak her mind, and use her platform. Of course, they would not like that. Second point that I think is important is nobody tells Ted Nugent, James Woods, or any other Republican supporters who they should not vote for or who they should not influence. But with Taylor Swift, the Republicans think that they should have an opinion. It is kind of the same situation with Charlie Kirk when an athlete expressed the opinion that the Republicans didn't like that they were minimalized and marginalized and told to keep their opinions to themselves. And then Charlie Kirk dies and have halftime memorials at football stadiums. Moreover, they chastise the ones that did not have the Charlie Kirk memorials. So a lot there to unpack in that note, obviously. But it is there's also no extinguishing of this flame, right? I mean, she only seems to further, like, there's no understanding. I mean, I think we think of this as pop stars that eventually they're going to flame out, and then their audience is going to change. But I don't know. One of the very, very few, and I don't know if Justin would agree with this or not, but it just seems like one of the very, very few people you could name that seems like they could actually be in it for the long haul.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, she was doing the Eras Tour, and then she released Tortured Poets Department during the Eras Tour, and that was a double album, and people were like, oh my God, this is crazy. And then more recently, she released Life of a Showgirl. I don't know. We might be seeing peak Taylor now. There's been a lot of hate towards Life of a Showgirl. Even some of her fans really saying that it's not her best work. I don't know. My brother-in-law loves it. He thinks it's family. He's a, yeah, not Gen Z, millennial. So I don't know. The people are talking about, have we reached like Taylor Swift's saturation point and people are just sort of done? Is she now going to get married and maybe take a little break? So we'll see. But, you know, she is so savvy that she might be one of these artists who can continually recreate themselves and make themselves relevant. So I think so. We'll see.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everyone for being with us. That was fun. I know. I think that's the key to most of these shows. I got to make sure I remember that when we start to bail, talk about it, Taylor Swift. I'll make sure that on our page we have a link to the study so people can read it, because it's really fascinating. Work, amazing stuff, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Thanks for giving me space. And I will say that there is a you can read the abstract of the article, but they are trying to get people to pay for the full article. So if anyone wants the full article, I will send you a PDF of it. But you can read a chunk of it through that link.
Good. That's good. Yes. That's what we'll share with people.
Yes,
get
wonderful.
Angry.
Appreciate it,
Justin. Thank you very much, Ashley. What a pleasure to have you here and. And Anna, thank you. Enjoy your car ride back.
We're going to listen to Taylor Swift.
Yes. happy birthday to Anna and to Justin. We'll be back right after this.